Before we actually get into the lectures in physics proper, I have an introduction to the guest today, and that is the Executive Director of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, Howard Burton, and he'll be saying a few words in a minute. Just to introduce Howard, Howard Burton is Executive Director of the Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, a position he has held since its inception, the Institute's inception in 1999. He is responsible for overseeing all aspects of the research and outreach mandates of the Institute's, its future direction, its growth, and also its day-to-day operations. In keeping with the Institute's strong emphasis on outreach, Howard speaks regularly at community events and makes frequent national and international media appearances, including recently on CBC Radio and Television, CNN, and CTV. In terms of his education, he holds a Bachelor of Science in Physics and Philosophy from the University of Toronto, a Master of Arts from the University of Toronto, or Master of Arts in Philosophy from the University of Toronto also, a Master of Science in Theoretical Physics from Imperial College of London, and a PhD in Theoretical Physics from the University of Toronto, of Waterloo, excuse me. Outside of science, Howard has deep abiding passions for music, theatre, and literature. So without any further ado,
excellent. So I'm not going to take up very much of your time. I just wanted to give you all a show welcome. It seems pretty hot. You should do that. Anyway, we'll look after that. Hopefully. We'll try anyway. Just wanted to say a few things. As Damien has probably told you, and as many of you know, this is not the first time we've been doing these Einstein Fund workshops. And I'm very, very pleased by the history and what we've been able to do. But this is still a work in progress, and we're very much counting on your feedback and your both informal and formal, just to give us a sense of how things are going and whether or not it's helpful for you or what we could be doing differently and so forth. We're very blessed to have, in addition to Damien and Ed James, also a bevy of volunteers who have done, I think, really a tremendous job of putting a very, very good lineup together. As you've doubtless seen, you'll be going to Stratford for a little bit of R&R, which I think will be particularly interesting for those who don't live in the area and haven't had the opportunity to sample for the likes of Stratford as often as some other stuff. It's not written in the schedule, but I think that I'm having a session on Friday afternoon, as we did last year, with all of you, which I'm looking forward to, which is an opportunity, again, to get some more concrete feedback from you as to what we might be able to do differently. You also will have the benefit of interacting with Tony Leggett, who's visiting at IQC. For the last couple of months and hopefully a month or two. In addition to being obviously a superlative mind and remarkably broad and informed physicist, Tony is also a wonderful human being and very approachable, and I'm sure you'll find that a delight. So I won't take up any more of your time. I'd just like to thank all the volunteers again for putting on what I anticipate to be a wonderful 4 days here. And and have a great time. And also, one other thing, don't hesitate in casual interaction. Often a lot of most interesting stuff, not to diminish what Damien is going to tell you, but most interesting stuff sometimes happens outside of the structured time, as I'm sure you're all aware. Please feel free to interact with the scientists who are here, the graduate students who are here, other people who are coming through, because that will help us enrich your experience. So have a great time, and I'll see you on Friday.
Just a couple of announcements. Hopefully everyone has their name tags this morning. So you will need that just to make sure that you get into the bistro and people don't mistake you for one of our researchers and therefore charge for lunch. So if you'd like a free lunch, please remember to make sure to keep your name tags on. One point. Okay. something else. We actually are very lucky to have a special guest to be here for today and tomorrow. And that's a journalist from the Toronto Star, their science reporter, Pete Calamine. He's actually just sitting over there. It's actually sort of one of Canada's leading science writers, and he's written sort of many articles, been a great supporter of science in general. And he found out about the workshop. He's going to be here, yeah, as I said, today and tomorrow, and mingling, and may well chat to you to see what we're doing and see what you do with your students and so forth. So I've had experience from the past. He's a fantastic person, so please, please make him feel welcome. So thank you for coming along. Let me see. Yes, what we would like to do, so as part of making this workshop as good as possible, also for this year, next year, and years in the future, we'd like to get an idea of its impact, just in what effect it does have on you. So we have a short little survey, just about, I'll hand it out now, thanks, about trying to get an idea of how you feel about quantum physics now, your sort of confidence level, knowledge of it, and also for motivation. So what will, oh, actually, could I?
Yeah, the number.
Yeah, the number.
Down, down. What? Oh.
Could you actually request me?
Could you?
Yeah, where should we go?
Actually, no, specific number.
We number them all.
Yes.
They couldn't read my name.
Or just pass them around and I'll do the best.
Can I just add something? Guys, can I just add something to Howard, what Howard said about approach to researchers? I've been here long enough that I've seen this happen, and it's amazing. Yes. We were at a workshop once, and somebody was coming out and had this weird question about string theory. This is at the old facility, but this weird question about string theory, and they were kind of talking among each other, and I tapped him on the shoulder and said, why don't you ask that man sitting on the couch? He's the world's expert in string theory. It was Professor Myers. He's this guy who's like right up there. And they go, ooh, really? And they're afraid. And they went over and talked to him, and he's just a totally normal guy, and he was able to answer their questions in normal ways. And you'll be surprised, because sometimes we have this image that really, really smart people they can't be understood. But the guys in this facility, the researchers here, are so smart, they're actually able to then translate it to you. And it's an amazing feat. And I've watched this over and over again with students, with teachers, that these researchers love to sit down and talk about their stuff. And they will answer your bizarre questions. Now, sometimes they'll say, you know, to answer that goes way beyond what I think you can understand. I've also seen that happen, but don't be afraid of it. We've actually arranged later on in the week for you to have lunch with some researchers and things like that, to mingle with them. But it's a very comfortable environment. That's part of the design of the building. There's lots of little living rooms everywhere for them to sit around and talk. Feel free, you know, don't interrupt them if they're in the middle of one. There's derivation things on the blackboard. That's a dangerous situation. But obviously, feel free to ask them questions. They are very approachable.
Correct. Thank you for that. Thank you very much. So we're handing out a very, very short survey now. If we could take a couple of minutes to fill it in, that would be fantastic. We have actually seen, you notice there's a number in the top right-hand corner. So if you could actually, basically we want to sort of track in an anonymous way, anonymously, how people change from beginning of the workshop to the end. So what we've done is we've just wrote the numbers in, and then I shuffled the papers up, so they're not actually in order. So we have no idea, no one except you has any idea what number you have. So if you could fill in the survey, and somewhere maybe in your notes, the inside cover, or somewhere in your schedule, your key, you could just record the number that's in the top right-hand corner of your page, 3442. And just remember that, and it'll give you a survey at the end. If you just write your number again, I have no idea what, no one has any idea what your number is. We won't be checking or anything like that, up, down, or anything. So.
Okay.
No, it's just the sound. Actually, could you pass them to the AF? Good idea. Pass them to...
Hey, Ron, what's your number?
4.
Just fast in the slip.
How's the sound level quiet? How's that? Set up, if you're okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, okay, now that we've finished with the survey, what am I doing? I started explaining and telling you a little bit about the Institute that you'll be here for the next week. And I'm sure as you're here, you'll get a better idea of just what we're all about. But in terms of the science, the research that we do, why we're here, our mission. And one thing that is kind of unusual, we've talked about for the outreach mandate, is that actually sort of written in Perimeter Institute is equally two mandates. The one is to do the very best, make this one of the very best places in the world to do fundamental research theoretical physics, which is obvious. But also there's alongside of that is the outreach mandate. So, for example, this teacher's workshop. Another thing we will do or talk a bit about later is we have a summer school for high school students and various other programs. So, for example, last year, during the International Year of Physics, we staged Einstein Fest, which is a three-week-long public festival. To go to Einstein, science, and life, and times, kind of bring that to the general public. And we had probably about 20,000 people over the 3 weeks. But I have a little propaganda video, which goes for about 5 minutes. But I'll put that out now. Hopefully it gives you a bit of a better idea about some of the research areas that we do and what the Institute's about. So, okay.
When the Neurons casually skipped along the lunar surface, we think we live at home. What's around us and how everything works? Even though moon samples turned out to be not the much different than rocks here on Earth, complete with elements on the periodic table. Remember the periodic table from science class? All those symbols representing all the elements around us. Metals, carbons, gases, and more. Well, the complete periodic table describes just 4% of the known universe. That means so much more we don't know about matter, energy, and perhaps new dimensions twisting and turning inside it. Even today, there are forces of nature we don't fully understand at a fundamental level. Consider light. Why can't anything in the universe travel faster than the speed of a wave or particles of light? And what is gravity, and how does it really work? These are questions for bright minds known as theoretical physicists, scientists who contemplate the mysterious forces of nature and advance our understanding. Galileo did, and discovered that everything falls to Earth with the same acceleration. Isaac Newton built on that, and determined there is a universal force of attraction among bodies throughout the entire cosmos. And Albert Einstein, one of our most celebrated thinkers, explained that gravity is not a force at all, but a warping in the geometry of space and time. Extending theories like this can be transformative. When Maxwell discovered a unified theory of electricity and magnetism, a new understanding emerged. Marconi applied that understanding to send the first wireless message between continents, launching the communications age and revolutionizing our lives with radio, television, cell phones, and the internet.
How do you think I understand what quantum theory is telling us about the world?
Now human beings are asking even deeper questions, like, what's inside a black hole? Are the atoms we're made of really entangled with other matter across the universe? Helping propel the search for answers is Mike Lazaridis, the founder and co-CEO of Research in Motion. Along with dynamic partners in the public and private sectors, he is securing the future of foundational research because understanding drives innovation. Crafting the vision and turning it into reality is Dr. Howard Burton, Executive Director of Perimeter Institute. His new approach to scientific research and educational outreach brought researchers to Perimeter's first home, an old post office in the heart of Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. A temporary home with the freedom to collaborate in a lively atmosphere. Working together, or in complete solitude, scientists take their minds to strange new places. Yet he also works with the world of atoms, where a single particle appears to be in two places at the same time, opening an infinitesimally tiny world of quantum ideas. And deeper still, 20 powers of 10 smaller than nucleus, to quite possibly the very essence of everything. Streams or lymphs of electric flux, likely in strange dimensions, and perhaps vibrating in some kind of harmony with each other. And with all of space, time, and matter across the entire universe. Understanding everything, from the incredibly small to the infinite cosmos, is the bold mission of Perimeter Institute. Back on Earth, along the shore of Silver Lake, is the new home of Perimeter Institute, forged from steel, cement, and glass. A landmark, to be sure, but more importantly, an ideal research environment for a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate, calculate, contribute new ideas, and share their wisdom with others. Perimeter's outreach activities reach young minds across the country, while other students and even teachers travel to Waterloo from around the world to take part in special science camps, learn cutting-edge theory from the experts, follow ideas through to experiments, and lead inspired. For the general public, themed events are specifically tailored for all age groups. Exhibits, experiments, and programming share the transformative value of research and the joy of discovery. activities include popular monthly lectures where people gather to learn from perimeter scientists and special guests. Bizarre and abstract ideas are explained, personal stories shared, and questions answered.
Every element recorded carries with it bits of information.
The talks reach even wider audiences on television and through the Institute's growing website. All this from an award-winning center of inquiry dedicated to scientific research and educational outreach. A community of scholars investigating the world around us, adding to our collective understanding, sharing their insights with others, and building upon humanity's foundation of knowledge for generations to come. Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics. A new window on the mysteries of nature.
Okay, let's go with the physics. Okay. It'll just be a minute here. So this is the first example of cheating technique, not. Okay, so I think that will reboot. So while that's actually happening, some of you may have seen, you should have or at least one small little slate or whiteboard between two people and a marker. Does everyone have those or have one nearby?
Okay. Everybody should have
them. Everyone should have one? Great. Okay, so they are something that you'll be using in probably about 10-15 minutes. As I said, this will be very much, it's not a passive lecture, it'll be very much, like all the presentations this week, very much something which you'll be actively involved in. And so what these are used for, actually probably a number of you already use them. They're essentially for getting really real-time feedback, just getting some interactivity with your students. And how you can use them, we're talking more about them on Thursday afternoon in the section on physics education, research and techniques. And Diana Hall and Dave Doucette, who have been using for a number of years in their classes, will talk about them in various ways you can. But the basic idea is, you ask questions to your students. It could be a multiple choice question where you're looking for the answer A, B, C, or D, and they just write the answer on, and then everyone holds them up, and you can instantly find out and get a survey just how many of your students understand the point you're trying to explain. It doesn't have to be just A, B, C, or D. Something you can do, you can get them, you know, you're looking for what direction is the force in, or what would the arc of this basically be like, and something like that. You can actually get more complex things, but you can get, it's very easy to get to this kind of this snapshot of what's sort of going on in their minds. Can I just get a show of hands up, how many of you already use this or something like this in your classes? Okay, so sort of three or four people. Okay, good. So great, something new for the rest of you. So it's, again, Diana and Dave will talk about it, but it's something that has been around for a while, various variants. And the first I heard about it was, I think, from University of Iowa State University, a physics education research group there. But something that's very good, and also it's something that's low-tech. All you need is some slates, or even if you don't want to do that. With university classes, one thing I've done is just written down lots of A, B's, A4 pages, with one with letter A, another letter B, C, D, and made lots of copies of those and just handed them out. And then basically given sort of real-time delight multiple choice questions. Okay, almost there. Great, and it's a lot. Great. Okay. Great. Fantastic. And so it's obviously a lot better than trying to, you know, sort of read people's body language and sort of scrunched up faces. So we'll be using those in about 10 minutes, and you'll get to see how that works. Okay. The core concept of quantum theory. So really, this is sort of a modeling typical of what all these enrichment presentations are going to be in the morning. And what we'll look at is double slit experiments, something probably familiar to a lot of you. It's something that many, many authors use in popular books and also textbooks to really introduce quantum physics, because the essence of it is surprisingly simple. Just, you know, you have just some wave or some particles or whatever just going towards this wall with two holes in it, two slits in it. But even though the essence is surprisingly simple, you can actually get across a lot of the deep, key, core concepts. So it's a very, very useful vehicle for introducing it. And what I'm going to use that is really to explain what I see as four of the most fundamental elements of quantum physics. If you sort of strip away everything down to the skeleton, these are four of the most important things, in my opinion. So one is wave-particle duality, the fact that quantum entities have sort of wave-like properties, particle-like properties. Another is superposition. Just like with classical water waves, you can have quantum particles, in some sense, things that are both here and there, simultaneously. Another is the quantum world seems to be genuinely random, sort of indeterminacy, that you get, for example, with radioactive decay. According to quantum physics, you cannot, if you have a single uranium atom here, you cannot predict with certainty whether it will decay in an hour or a year or a day, or any other length of time. And the final one is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle. So here you have an electron or something like that. You cannot know both its position, where it's at, and its velocity, how fast it's going. And somehow this quantum universe has this sort of hardwired limit that does not allow you, no matter how good an experimenter you are, no matter how precise your experiment is, to find out both of these two properties, these two things that, you know, you think you should be able to measure. And finally, a little bit on sort of why is quantum physics or quantum theory so tough to understand. I think it's tough for everyone. Okay. So what's the purpose? What's the point of all these morning presentations? So as I said last night, they're not really directly for your students. So we're not looking at things, you know, these are notes you could directly give to your students, but more these are for you. So I think a big thing with a lot of teachers is just sort of feeling comfortable, having confidence with teaching modern physics, and feeling like you're really on top of it. You're two or three layers below your students, you're two or three steps ahead of them. And so these are designed to give you a richer, deeper understanding of the modern physics that you teach, and also to increase your confidence with it. So these are the main points. So I should say, please feel free to ask any questions at any time. And so what's kind of this philosophy that's guiding this week in the core concepts? And that is really starting with the question that I think of, if I was a high school teacher, what would I want my students, or what do you want your students to walk out of the classroom on the last day after you've taught them maybe a week, 2 weeks, four lessons, five lessons, or whatever, remember an understanding about modern physics, or indeed about any other topic that you deal with? What do you want to really stick in their minds and them to have a good idea about? And one answer is the core concepts of quantum theory and special relativity, that you maybe don't necessarily want them to walk out and remember that in 1900 it was Max Planck from Germany that came up with the quantum hypothesis and so forth in the history. But really the idea from that, probably the main idea, is you can think of light as made up of tiny sort of discrete bundles of energy, photons, energy or light energy is quantized. And there's a quote there from 1994, Nobel Prize winner in physics, David Pollitzer from Caltech, is very, very big on physics teaching, mainly at the university level, but just consistent with that, talking about the idea that And when he teaches, at least, he tries to get students to the forefront of physics as the most important point. And even though that may involve sort of being short on history, sort of cutting some corners there, because realistically, you don't have a whole semester or class or, you know, weeks and weeks, months and months to teach modern physics. You only have a limited amount of time. So in some sense, it makes sense to cut to the chase. So this is an ahistorical perspective. And given that you just have realistically a very limited amount of time, history can be a distraction. So this is really the philosophy we're going to be taking. So just something to kind of ease into things. So looking at the double slit experiment, so we'll just forget about quantum physics, quantum theory for now. Imagine you have a brick wall with a very narrow vertical slit. You can see there. And just happen to have a huge bucket. It has 100,000 tennis balls in it. And next, beside that, is a bucket of paint, black paint. And you've got a bit of time in your hands, and you know, you feel being a bit experimental. So you actually pick up the first tennis ball, sort of dip it in the bucket of black paint, and then you throw it at the wall here, you can see here. And then you repeat that process. Basically, so by the end of it, you're throwing 1,000 tennis balls. And you don't sort of have this sort of laser sight-guided device or machine that precisely pinpoint throws every tennis ball exactly the same way. But generally, you're just picking them up, and you're aiming for the wall here, or the slit here. But maybe, you know, every tennis ball won't be exactly the same way sent flying towards the wall here. And so some will probably, you know, a few will hit here and bounce off, but we're not really worried about the balls bounce off. We're just worried about, you know, there'll be some fraction of a fairly good aim that will get through the black wall here, the back wall. And so the question is, if you do this, after you've thrown 1,000 tennis balls, you get these sort of, you know, paint splotches and some kind of pattern in the back wall. So what pattern, roughly speaking, just looking for a very crude estimate or idea in the essential features, what sort of pattern would you get on the back wall? So we have four choices there. So there's this sort of one, you can see all the four options there. That's the wall there with the slit. So it's not meant to be a tough question, you know, just easing you into it. So what I'd like you to do is just find, so make sure you do this in teams. So maybe look at the people on either side. If you get groups of two or three, and just very quickly decide. But seeing it's fairly simple, if I just have your attention for a second. So for those ones that you don't think are right, you think are incorrect, what sorts of misconceptions or things do you think might be going on in a student's mind or someone's mind that might pick the three answers that you don't think are right? So what sort of misconceptions or naive conceptions or misunderstandings might you think lead to this three answers that you don't think are correct? So I'll give you about three and a half minutes. Yes. Yes, yeah. Yeah, so it's kind of hard to get those expensive verticals. Yeah. Okay, 1.5 minutes. Attention. So if everyone can hold up their... Okay. Yep, great. So pretty much everyone had A. So that was the answer I was looking for. So the basic ideas you get, most of them clustered around behind the slit you have, but you actually get, it's sort of a bell-shaped or a Gaussian distribution. So you get most of them in the middle here and then sort of lesser amounts of the sort of the bell-shaped. Going around like that. So that was the answer looking for. Great, fantastic. Okay, so we'll just change it slightly. So let's move the slit along from being here over the other side. Just repeat the whole thing. 1,000 painted tennis balls, throwing them in, seeing the pattern that we get. And we just get exactly the same thing, except obviously it's shifted along, so it's in line with where the slit is. So that's the second experiment. So let's do another one. And so let's open up both slits. So we have this wall, someone knocks out two small slits there, and then repeat the same exercise again. Throw the 1,000 painted tennis balls at the wall, sort of in this haphazard manner, sort of taking reasonable aim. So the question is, what sort of pattern then, roughly speaking, would we get? So we'll just do this one. Again with the whiteboards, reasonably quickly. So maybe I'll give you about a minute just to discuss with those around you. And also, if you get the answer right away, maybe think about what misconceptions again might lead students to come up with the three answers that you don't think are right. So I'll just give you maybe 60 seconds. I don't know. Okay, 20 seconds. Okay, that's enough time. So, Gerald can show up. Great. B, fantastic. So, correct. And I'll just say, just we will be using this technique a number of times during class. And so the thing is, it's very much anonymous because you went to the extent that you can't actually see, you know, what the other people have. And also, given that we're doing it in groups, if you happen to get the wrong answer, you always have someone else. Okay. One thing I have actually found this useful for is actually sort of adapting my lectures and presentations, depending on how many students get it right. So obviously, if everyone, 90% of people came back B, only a small percent of people came with B, then I know, well, okay, you know, my explanation, they didn't get that, then I'll maybe repeat it or try and explain it a different way. So it's very good for actually varying your lecture, your presentation, class in response to that. Okay, so what we've been looking at is tennis balls, and you can consider them as an example of an abstract particle. And we didn't have to actually use tennis balls. And what we've just seen, the patterns are typical for particle behavior, particle-like behavior. And we could have used to replace the tennis balls by billiard balls, by bullets, rocks, specks of dust. And if we, you know, we got the slits right and we somehow found ways of actually shooting all those cups of particles at the wall, then we get the same basic type of pattern. So it's not just, you know, a special feature about tennis balls, bullets, whatever. So they are patterns we've seen as sort of standard, typical of particle-like behavior. So let's think about the same sort of experiments we've just been looking at, but let's, instead of tennis balls, let's go on to water weights. So what we might have is similar sort of setup, sort of wall here, and with wall at the back and a wall with the narrow gap. So it could be a seawall, some sort of big wall, it could be a harbour, there's some sort of big concrete wall to try and, you know, protect the harbour or the boats in the harbour from any harsh waves and storms. And there's a gap in there. Imagine we have a plane wave, so just some kind of water waves coming at right angles, hits the wall. So what happens? So what we have is a wave that's represented, you know, wave is a spread out thing, not like a particle which is localized in space. And it's spread out sort of everywhere. You might need some sort of field that we have at every point in space an amplitude or a height for the wave. And what we actually get is really this sort of main peak here is the main thing, but also we can get diffraction. To get, I guess, the diffraction fringes here, you have to assume you've sort of got some sort of vertical. There's some sort of vertical aspect to the slit. But the main point is really the diffraction. You actually get, as you know, the light wave sort of spreading out here, which is something you don't get with particles. So you get sort of spreading out the light waves, you have sort of the amplitude here, and we'll kind of use sort of a strange symbol, maybe sort of instead of A, the amplitude of the wave, just, you know, we'll be kind of fancy here, we'll use sort of a letter of the Greek alphabet, psi. So psi, this letter we use just for the amplitude of the wave. So just, you know, when you read that, I think it's just nearly good old-fashioned amplitude. And the details of how much diffraction there is, we have to depend, we're getting good, but it depends on the wavelength, obviously, of the water waves, how wide the slit is, and what you actually see here depends also on what's the geometric configuration of the slit, and also just the distance of where you're actually looking at the wave pattern from here, this distance here. But the general, I mean, basically, the details don't change, and you get this diffraction, this spreading out. Okay. So let's move on to the next experiment. So we've got two slits. So we're looking at a wave incident on a seawall with two holes or two slits in it. So it's kind of the diagram of the wave there coming along towards the two slits. And we'll label them slit one and slit two. And what you end up seeing is the standard double slit interference pattern. So what you actually have is, so we can think of the total wave. We might have this sort of x-axis here. Again, we're at some point here. And we're looking to see just how the wave intensity varies, just, you know, how the height of the waves and the intensity varies as we go along this sort of x-axis here. And what we find out is this wave coming here towards the wall with the two slits in it, the seawall, what happens, basically, each of those slits sort of acts like a source of roughly spherical waves. So we have sort of the hole here, we have sort of waves spreading out, you can see from that slit, and slit one over here, again, waves spreading out. So you sort of have this sort of initial single wave, plane wave, actually split up into two components. And if you want to represent that sort of mathematically by a simple equation, we might look at the total amplitude of the wave at any point along this x-axis. And we could think that, say, 100 meters out from the harbor and 100 meters out from where the seawall is, we could have this line of buoys just sitting there all tied together, and we could just measure the intensity by just seeing how much each of them bobs up and down, the height that they bob up and down. And the greater the height that they bob up and down, the more sort of vigorous motion is there, the greater the intensity is there, the more energy is there with the wave. And so the actual amplitude of the wave at each point along this road here, that's actually, basically, there are two components contributing to that. There's one that's kind of, in a sense, you can think of this spherical wave here coming out from the second slit, and also the spherical wave coming out from the first slit here. So we've got these sort of two components, and again, if you want to represent that mathematically, what we might have is where we have the psi, or the amplitude for the wave coming out of slit one, just the mathematical way of representing that, and the wave coming out, sorry, of slit two there, and slit one here. And so if we want to find out, say, this particular one here right in the middle, what's the total amplitude, and then we square that total amplitude to get the intensity. What we have to do is look at really the, so the amplitude from coming from the first slit, and then add to that the amplitude coming from the second slit, just add the two amplitudes together, and then square that number, and then we'll take square that number, and what that gives us is, that gives us the total amplitude at that point. Oh, actually, sorry, add the two numbers together, then square that, that gives us the total intensity at that point. And if we do that, we find that the waves are in phase at this point here, so we get constructive interference, you know, a crest meets a crest, trough meets a trough, so we actually get, if you put a little buoy there out in the bay, what you would get is that would be sort of bobbing up and down at a very large height, considerable height. But if you go a little bit further and along here, the x-axis, so along further, and the details depend on the slit widths, the distance from here to here, the wavelengths of the water, and other details. But what you would have, eventually you get destructive interference, that by phase of pi, 180 degree, the wave coming from this slit here is out of phase by that amount with the wave coming from that slit. So you actually get destructive interference. So, you know, a crest meets a trough, and they cancel each other out, and you actually get very still buoy there. So you actually sort of get no action with the waves in terms of the buoy bobbing up and down, so destructive interference. And it's interesting, from a mathematical point of view, if you sort of look at what you have here and physically what you have here, you have this one wave plus another wave. And so you have superposition. You have these sort of two components added or superposed on top of each other, giving you and leading to the total path. And our superposition is something very important and one of the key elements of quantum theory, as we'll see in a while. So this is something that we have for water waves. It's just interference, two waves combining, interfering either constructively or destructively with each other. And this is probably a key equation here, showing that you just get the one component and the other component. Yes?
Damien, I can understand this. And we apply this back to the previous slide where the destructive interference occurs. Here we've got superposition.
Right.
On the previous slide where we have some nodal points.
Yep.
You can't explain that by superposition.
Well, there's a way in which you can. I mean, you can think of the single slit diffraction. One way a lot of textbook use is thinking of. Yeah, I mean, it's not obvious that you can, but one way a lot of textbooks use is thinking of. With a single slit, you can think of each, sort of like a Huygens principle thing, you can think of each of the points along there being a source of a spherical wave. So you have all these spherical waves coming out here. And so you do have, you know, for as many points as you want to have there, you have these spherical waves coming out. And then they Basically, all sort of interfere with each other. And let's see, what is it? The I think it's sine theta equals m. Is that right? Lambda over a. Is that the? Is that right? Is that?
Yeah.
Okay. That then yeah. Then what you find is that basically the.
So we're using that slit as multiple point source.
So yeah. So that's one model of the slit. You can basically each little point creating a wavelet, and then that sort of basically then spreading and then interfering in this sort of complicated way.
So that's using the same explanation as the second slide.
Yeah, rough. I mean, generally speaking, in terms of the interference pattern. So yeah, so it's a different phenomenon. It's sort of diffraction of spreading out, but you can think of it in terms of the interference of these wavelets here. So that's one way. Yeah, but it's not obvious because you think we just have one wave that, you know, interference is something, but it gets with two things or three things or four things. So yeah, I mean, that is a little bit. So that's perhaps a little. I should actually be careful of what I have there. Just be clear. That's actually, you actually get that if you have a vertical slit, then you do see the horizontal pattern across. If you have more sort of vertical slit like this, then you see, this is where you see kind of the diffraction minima and maxima. So you've got to be careful of the geometric configuration that you have. But is that, yep.
Yeah, no, I think you just finally answered his question. I think his question was that this picture here looks a lot like the picture on the
chart. Okay, right.
So
yeah.
Would you explain in the same way? And you just explained it. The first picture, you get the little side bumps because of diffraction. The second picture, you get the little side bumps because of destructive and constructive interference.
Right, yep. Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
I have a question to ask.
Yes.
My understanding is if I extend it to a multi-slit gradient,
yep,
then the pattern remains the same. Is that correct?
Which pattern?
That pattern right there. So instead of having a double slit, let's say I have...
Oh, that's a single slit there.
Oh, I'm sorry, the other one.
This one.
It's just a rough sketch, and it doesn't actually... Right.
You do get some...
Yes.
The fraction gradient, you're going to get equal spacing and equal deeps.
Yeah.
So when that dies off. So that sort of tails off their intensity. That sort of has some envelope around it. The diffraction you'll get sort of more even. But you do get the diffraction, the interference with the diffraction gradient. So you get a lot of common features. But yes?
Back on the single slit there, would it be wrong to explain that as that's intensity wave that it's greatest in the center because that the screen right there is most tangential to the curve at that point, so you have more intensity? And then you see that where it drops, if you extended those circles, let's say,
mm-hmm,
that it would be tangential right there at the center, so the distance would matter.
Yes.
Slightly to the side, you find yourself moving into a trough, and then you find yourself going back up onto the crest of the wave. See what I'm saying?
Yeah. But I don't think that quite works because if here you'll get... Where you'll actually get at this point you'll get all sorts of phases. You'll get troughs for a little while, and then you'll get basically in between a crest and a trough, and then a trough. So you'll actually, if you're watching there, you'll actually see. I mean, basically, if you're watching there and you're a swimmer, you'll actually see basically being bobbed up and down. So each point is getting.
You're saying it stays that way, as far as. Like it stays up in the air.
With intensity, that's why you square you square it so you take care of the negative trough in the end.
Yeah. You won't stay up there. You'll actually see alternatively a crest trough. And so if you look sort of the average of the square of those of some reasonable period of time, basically that's what gives you this intensity here. So because normally these are always just sort of averaged over some period. Because the waves are coming out, and so this is essentially like a water wave. So if you're a swimmer there again, you'll be sort of going up and down. So you actually see you would see all the different phases, if you like, of the wave.
I was looking at, it's more like it had that line of voids there, that at the center, you'd see more of them moving up and down. Rather than an amplified version, you'd just see more of them.
Well, you can kind of have them evenly spaced out here. So they would go up higher. The details would depend exactly on the configuration. But yeah, there'd be more, they would go up higher. But you kind of have them evenly spaced out, so you probably wouldn't see more, but they'd go up. Does that make sense?
The fact that they're going up higher isn't making sense right now. The fact that there's more of them, and therefore maybe the intensity therefore is related that way.
Right, yeah. But, you know, more of the boys, you mean? Or,
yeah, it's
right.
More of the boys in the middle.
Yeah.
Like I say, just the tangential respect to the stream, but the fact that they're going higher is not quitting the migration.
Okay. So I guess it's kind of like you have a line along here. And you just have that, you have a higher, I mean, you have greater, really greater amplitudes, or really magnitudes of the amplitudes. Sort of along this, basically along the middle point here. And so if you're actually looking at sort of how much this would evolve up and down. You can look at it if you think of, basically sort of divide up all of these points along here into individual little sources, spherical waves, and you actually get all of these coming out here. You get them all, they'll all be in phase with each other, so you get this constructive interference. And when you get constructive interference, obviously they all sort of build upon and are in sync with each other. And then that leads to the buoy, so the greater, basically more energy at that point, and the buoy bobbing up and down higher.
How do I come by? So it's not okay. It's not really a singular circular wave that's heading out. It's rather needs to be seen as multiple.
There are different models, different ways of looking at it. The mathematics is the same, but it can be very helpful, you know, to look at it in terms of Huygens wavelets and so forth. It's kind of hard to, in some sense, maybe you don't understand this or the pattern you get with the vertical slit, the horizontal pattern, in terms of being this thing coming out of the slit being made up of multiple components. So. Okay, one interesting thing is we've talked about some water waves and particles, but it turns out that some scientists, and there's actually a reference there, it's from the 1980s, they've actually done this, basically the double slit experiment, the same experiment that we had here, and they actually did that with electrons. And it's interesting to think, so what actual pattern did they get? And so some scientists at Hitachi, they're in Japan. That's a reference to the paper there, and there's a web link to a little explanation they have. And so let's consider what would happen with just one slit open. So again, sort of a real experiment. So I guess this is sort of looking at, are electrons like just like tiny, tiny scaled down tennis balls? Sort of classical ordinary particles? Or are they more like water waves, or are they more like other sorts of weird, strange animals? So this is really one of the things, well, I guess they kind of knew the theory beforehand, but one of the things they were experimentally probing in the experiment. So just what kind of animals or beasts are electrons? So one slit open, and so we had sort of the wave, it's a wave spread out thing. So you represent that by just by specifying the amplitude A or psi or whatever letter we're going to use at every point sort of spread out in space. And so what quantum physics tells you, or quantum theory tells you, just as you want to do that for a wave, so it's actually useful to have, you want to model an electron, then you need to represent that again, the spread out sort of field, if you like, which has sort of a value at each point in space, and we'll call that psi with the little e down the bottom there to denote that's an electron. Just as a technical detail, it's not really important for our discussion, But with the field here, the amplitude is a real number. It's always, you know, 3.4 minus 2.1. It's, you know, it's a real number. But kind of one thing, again, it's not really important, but you can actually get the field in quantum physics. The electron or proton or any other particle can actually be a complex number. So it can have imaginary components there. So it could be 1 plus I. But that's just a technical detail. So the main point is, again, just as with a water wave, we have this spread out sort of field we can represent an electron. And that's the representation of it there. And so in the experiment, they had the details. They had a very narrow slit, effectively, around a micrometer wide. It was sort of a vertical slit, so it had a vertical aspect to it, right? That's important. And they got the electrons going very, very quickly. So that's it's probably about a third of the speed of light, so 120,000 kilometers per second. So basically, it had very, very hot electrons that were just shooting out of filament. A lump of metal they lit up very, very hot. And they had this final wall here quite some considerable distance away, so a long way away from the wall, from the initial wall. And what they had is, so there's sort of an electron gun there. But really, all the experiments, what they do is it's a sort of a hot filament. It's a very, very hot piece of metal. They heat up to a couple of thousand degrees, and eventually you ionize the atoms there. You actually give the electrons enough energy, so they just basically free and sort of pop out, fire out, and you have some, they come out here. So they do with a large, large number of electrons. So, okay. And the question is, what sort of probability pattern? So again, we do this with thousands of electrons. And one strange thing, or one interesting thing, is so they had, what I should say is they had this wall here, and they just had this array of detectors all lined up along there that basically measured to see where the electrons hit. Did they hit there, there, or there? And what it turned out, whenever they did that, they always saw the electrons actually being hitting at one particular spot, localized. So they hit bang right, whoops, at that point, or at that point, or at that point, or at that point. There's always some particular well-defined spot. So what we, given that's the case, what we want to know is what kind of distribution, you know, the probability distribution or spread, the way the electrons were hitting. Were they all hitting over here, or there, or there? So that's what we wanted to find out. So this is a little bit trickier question. Maybe if you sort of have a take a stab at this and have a think about this, what sort of pattern they did actually see. So again, we've got a vertical slit here, and we've got these electron guns, and you're firing sort of large number of electrons. And so very sort of roughly, crudely speaking, what sort of general pattern for the probability distribution or the distribution of electrons do you think you'll find as the second wall be? So I'll give you a couple of minutes, maybe 3 minutes, to talk amongst those people around you. And then what we'll do is we'll find out the answer. Yep. Oh, right. So the position is the position. And what you really want to find is the answer to the past values why it's reminding you. It's like the line story. Yeah, so you actually want to find what you have to do is take a point of what you have and what you have to do. And I mean, it's actually, you've got to take a point of what that means. Everyone could put their answers up. Great. Fantastic. Excellent. So, this is what we get. Probably that's what they found in the experiment. So, A. So again, this is the diffraction pattern. And so I think to a lot of people, it's probably not a surprise to you, but a lot of people, I mean, students, general public, have this idea of electrons as particles, exactly, kind of like sort of very, very tiny, minute scale down variables. And to see this sort of wave-like pattern, sort of you find with waves, is kind of strange. And just going back to, we have this size. So we have, again, instead of this sort of water wave field, well, we have this sort of this electron field. And again, instead of looking at intensity, well, we're looking at the probability, because just the probability of finding electrons at particular points along here. Let's just compare with. Yeah.
It's Latin.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the Latin is, but. So, we have this here, sort of this size is sort of spread out. And what people look at a probability path, it's actually instead of sort of the amplitude of the water wave, it's actually a probability amplitude. Because just as with the water wave, where the amplitude of the wave is high, you have a lot of energy there, a lot of intensity, if you've got a large sort of psi value or the sort of amplitude there, that corresponds to having a high probability of finding an electron at that particular point. So if you look at the psi or and the psi is actually the term for that, it's actually the technical term is, I think I don't have it up there. But that's something that physicists talk about as a wave function. That's sort of a wave function, the technical term. But it's sort of a probability field or a probability amplitude. And so this sort of peak here will correspond to a large value of psi and a large value here, a zero value there, just as we've got sort of large, small amplitudes of waves, then you get large and small intensities, respectively.
I'm just thinking, for if we want people to choose between whether it's a wave or a particle,
yep.
Wouldn't it just, I guess B would be a particle thing, but wouldn't it be good to have a choice that's kind of like a tennis ball?
That would be good. So you would maybe change B for just a whole, so something more like.
Yeah.
So that one, so that would be a good, okay.
If we want to carry on from that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. So that would be a good distractor. So that would really, you're saying that would really bring out students that have this particle mentality. Yeah, good. Good point. Well, we can change that for next week. So we have this, this sort of kind of this probability amplitude here, psi, in sort of comparing it with sort of the wave amplitude. Kind of like that, but it's a little bit different. And so before we sort of took the magnitude of the amplitude and we squared it, and we got this intensity of the wave. But we're not doing that. If we do that, what we actually get is a probability of finding an electron at one particular point along the x-axis. And that's illustrated by these probability diagrams on the previous page. And all of these can be actually considered of the magnitudes of psi squared. And two key points, as I mentioned before, one kind of dissimilarity with water waves. Water waves is a spread out thing. You have one water wave goes through, you find sort of the energy spread out over a wide area. With electrons, you always measure, you always see them being here or there. You know, when you look at them, you know, they're always, as I said, they always sort of hit the screen at here or there or there. And you actually get diffraction between walls A and B. So it's a curious mix of sort of particle and wave-like properties. Yes?
The speed at which they send the electrons to those double slits, do they vary that? Do you see any difference?
Not that I am aware of. They, what they will have done, just to the extent that that probably would have been the average speed of the electrons, and there would have been some variation there. Just to get some distribution of speeds, but they didn't actually do that experiment when they I don't think they systematically varied speeds and looked at it. But what they would,
they got it.
Sorry?
Let's change the width of the diffraction.
Yeah, yeah, that's true. Yeah, so we'll change the wavelength, but yeah, but they didn't systematically vary it. So I think it would be, as you make it slower, generally quantum theory predicts it will be easier to, easier to see the diffraction. I think it should get narrower. But they didn't, they hadn't done that. But having said that, there's lots of experiments that have done with all sorts of particles, with neutrons, diffraction experiments, and even you'll see a little bit later, sort of buckyballs, which are 60 carbon atoms sort of stuck together. They've actually done similar sorts of experiments with these, and these have been going at different velocities. So I think with the buckyballs, these 60 carbon atoms together, what they did was they had speeds around at 300 meters per second, so which is obviously very, very different to...
maybe closer to the speed of light, that would affect it.
Right. Well, yeah, that would be interesting. So it would be very, very hard to do that. You need a lot of energy. So there's a lot of technical details here. But then you'd have to actually take relativistic effects into account, and that would get... I'm sure you'd see the same sort of phenomena, but things would you'd have to start taking relativistic effects into account. But just technically, I don't think anyone has done that experiment. There are very few things on planet Earth we can get up to the speed of light besides light. Okay. So what they did, or what you can do, is you can basically close slit 1, open slit 2, so just move the hole along a bit, and then you see the same sort of path that's just shifted along. So the same as what we saw in the previous case with the particles with the transport. So what happens when both slits are open? And so a lot of students think of electrons as kind of like tiny scaled down minute tennis balls, sort of hard spheres. And so if you have this intuition, what pattern would we actually see at wall B with both slits open? And what I'd like you now to do is to just quickly with the people around you, consult, assuming you have students and you have a student, they're thinking that kind of intuition. What sort of rough patterns to do a sketch of a rectangle plus just the distribution of dots that they would predict they would see in the final wall? Yeah. After this. Sorry? I'll kind of... Okay. So what does that mean? It just changes the quality. What does that add? So most of the patterns look something like that. So they're too narrow kind of bands there. Absolutely right. So that's exactly what we saw for the case with tennis balls. So basically something like that. So what we will do now is, so it's 10:30, we're going for about an hour and a half. So what we'll do is we'll take a 15-minute coffee break, just out there in Bistro. And we'll reconvene at exactly 11:45 and 10:45.